Hi there. Thank you for tuning into this podcast. My name is Vic Veer. I'm an ENT consultant surgeon, which in America means an attending. I work at the Royal National ENT Hospital in central London, which is a part of University College London Hospitals. And I also work at Queen's Hospital in Romford, Essex. Now, in this podcast, what I'm going to do is talk about treatment options for a blocked nose. I'll probably go over other stuff as well, because the idea of this podcast is to allow me to speak at length about things and give you a more sort of deeper understanding about these certain subjects I want to talk about. Now, a lot of this information is found on my YouTube channel. So if you have a look at that, you might get extra details as well. Because the attention span is slightly shorter there, people have to have it in little chunks. So they're sort of scattered throughout the 2 or 3 years I've been doing YouTube for. So you might find value looking at that or just listening to this, and hopefully this will be all that you require. So let's just dive into the podcast. And I want to start off by explaining that most people do not know that they have a blocked nose. They may notice when their nose is blocked during a cold or a flu, and it's completely blocked at that point. Or they may find that they have issues in the hay fever season or something like that. But little do they know that during the rest of the year, rather than just the hay fever season, they're also slightly blocked, and they just have got used to that level of obstruction. Sometimes the only way to explain it or show it to people is to look up their nose and show them the big turbinates or the big twist in their nose and say, this is what your nose looks like. This is what it should look like. And this is what it currently looks like. And even then, some people say, well, my nose feels fine. Only when you convince them to correct it do they go, oh my God, I didn't realize how blocked my nose was. And I just didn't realize I'd lived my life like that for such a long time. There are some things you can do to try and work out whether or not you actually have a blocked nose or not. So I normally deal with people with snoring and obstructive sleep apnea, and having a blocked nose certainly makes that worse. So I often say to people, well, if you don't believe that you have a blocked nose, and maybe during the day you're all right, when you go to see your surgeon in the in their clinic, there's an awful lot of adrenaline going through your body, and that can shrink down the lining of your nose to allow you to breathe better. So when someone looks up your nose with a telescope, they might say, oh, no, this looks fine. Don't worry about it. And if you imagine having this telescope going up your nose, it is going to cause a sort of rush of adrenaline at that point. Sorry, I think the Americans call it epinephrine. But in any way, what happens is that your nose can get better during the day or get worse, particularly at night when you're lying down. When you're lying down, more fluid is distributed closer to your head. But when you're standing up, the fluid sort of drains down slightly. And so you can be okay during the day, but much, much worse at night. For example, those people who have problems at night and seem to wake up frequently at night, who have disturbed sleep because of their nose, it may be worth thinking to yourself, before you get out of bed, the first thing you do when you wake up is not sit up and get out of bed and go down the stairs and make a cup of coffee, whatever your normal morning routine is. But before you even move, try sniffing. Just sniffing through your nose, one side and the other, to see if it feels slightly wet or blocked or whatever. You might start noticing, actually, my nose is quite blocked. But by the time I go down the stairs, make my cup of coffee or tea, I've noticed that actually my nose feels a bit more open now. And you might suddenly start realizing, actually, my nose is open during the day, but blocked at night. Another way to think about it is, if your nose is blocked on both sides, you tend to have to breathe through your mouth at night. So if you wake up in the morning with a dry mouth, because the mouth isn't really designed to help you breathe, it's more of a backup system for breathing. You're meant to be able to breathe through your nose at night rather than your mouth. But if you're waking up with a dry mouth each morning, it's very likely that you have a blocked nose at night, and therefore you're relying on your backup system, your mouth, to breathe. And breathing through your mouth dries up the saliva there. So you wake up a bit parched and you have to drink water to try and moisten your mouth to stop it from getting so sort of dry feeling in the morning. So some people leave water by the side of their bed because their mouth gets so dry at night, and then they wake up and go for a wee, and it disturbs their sleep in other ways. A more extreme version of looking at whether or not your nose is blocked at night is to use mouth tape. Now, I don't really approve of mouth tape, and you'll see this in some of my videos, but some people, assuming that they don't have obstructive sleep apnea, you can put some mouth tape to close your mouth and not let any air in and out through your mouth, and then see if, say, you're watching TV for half an hour, if you find it difficult to watch that TV or do some other task whilst breathing through your nose only. And sometimes you can use it mouth tape at night to see if your nose feels blocked. You might find actually after half an hour lying in bed that your nose feels slightly blocked up, and you wouldn't have noticed that unless you used the mouth tape in the first place. You could just close your mouth and try and sleep with your, or just lie in bed with your mouth closed. But it's often quite hard to do that. People naturally slightly open their mouth and get a little bit of air in that way. But mouth tape is a way of sort of investigating whether or not you have a blocked nose. There is another way of doing this later on, and I'll explain this, because what I want to do now is talk about the four main reasons why your nose may be blocked. So I'm going to go through these one by one and do a little bit of detail on each, and then come back to it later to talk about the treatment options, which is the main focus of today's podcast. So the four reasons why someone may have a blocked nose. So the first one is a deviated nasal septum. So what I mean by that is the midline partition. So if you look up your nose, you'll see the two nostrils and the little line between them, which is what we would call the septum. That midline partition, that sort of dividing line between the two nostrils, is called the septum. And that can be twisted to one side or the other. Often when you look at just, if you look at the sort of like a worm's eye view of your nose and you look up your nose, the front bit looks very normal. Sometimes it is twisted off to one side. If that's the case, it's obvious that you have a deviated nasal septum. It's twisted to one side rather than the other. And therefore, one nostril seems smaller than the other nostril. But often it's not as obvious as that. You need to actually look up your nose into the nose so you can see maybe that one wall of the septum, say on the right-hand side, is bulging into the right-hand side. What happens is that one nostril seems larger when you look inside the nose compared to the other side, which looks smaller because the partition has shifted, not in the midline, in the center of the nose, but it's moved over to one side or the other. Another way to check is to look at the outside of your nose. If the outside of your nose, the bridge of your nose, is twisted to one side or the other, normally due to a traumatic injury or something like that, then it's very likely that the internal structure of the nose is also twisted to that side, but sometimes weirdly to the other side. It really depends on what sort of trauma that person has had. So if you have a deviated nasal septum, that means that this midline partition is shifted to one side or the other. If it's shifted over to the right-hand side, you can't breathe as well through the right-hand side compared to the left. So the way to test for this would be to put your finger on the right or left nostril and sniff on both sides. And if you find that you can breathe ever so slightly better on one side compared to the other side, then you'll think, maybe my nose is twisted. And if you see that twist by looking up your nose in the mirror, or sometimes even using those little cameras that can look up people's noses, you'll see that actually, wow, my nose is twisted to one side. I didn't realize it was twisted. I'll come back to the treatment of that later. I'm going to go on to the second of the four reasons why your nose could be blocked. And I think this is the most common one, which is increased swelling inside the lining of your nose. Now, there are things not in the midline of the nose. There are things called turbinates, which are on the outside of the internal cavity of your nose, not touching the septum, but on the opposite wall, closer to your cheeks rather than the septum, the midline part. And these turbinates are, they look a little bit like gills. They're curved bits of bone surrounded by soft tissue. And there are three or four of them on each side, curling down. As I said, they look like gills on the inside of your nose. And the purpose of these turbinates is to humidify or sort of wet the air as you breathe it in. And it's also to warm up the air as you breathe it in. That's very important because if you had very dry, cold air going into your lungs, what most people know, if you try to run out into the cold from a warm house and took a huge breath in, you'll feel it quite cold and raspy in your lungs. And it sort of hurts slightly. You need to really humidify the air so it helps the oxygen inside it to, it's easier for it to be transferred across into your bloodstream. And also you need it to be warmed up so it doesn't cause what we'd call bronchospasm. That means the lungs sort of contract a little bit to stop this cold air from going in. It cools you down too much, as it were. And the lungs react by closing down and stopping as much air coming into your lungs as before. So these three or four turbinates on both sides, one is above the other. So what you get is the inferior, or the lowest turbinate. So the inferior turbinate, then the middle turbinate, then the superior turbinate, which is up near the bridge of your nose now, near between your eyes. And then there is also the supreme turbinate that not many people have, but most of them are not particularly sort of studied or looked at, because the one that we all worry about is the inferior turbinate. That's because it's the largest and it sits very close to the area that you breathe through. If you look at your nostril in the mirror, and you'll see your upper lip in the midline of your upper lip, and then you can see it goes into the septum of your nose, that midline partition. If you look at the bottom of your nostril in the bottom corner near the midline, that's the area that you breathe through. It doesn't go up towards your brain, the flow. It goes straight back, sort of to the point where your ears are. So it goes from your nose straight backwards. This is the airflow going into your nose. And the idea of this airflow is to get this into your throat and into your lungs. So it doesn't really go up into the upper parts of your nose. The reason for those areas are for your sinuses and for your sense of smell and things like that. So there is some air that goes up there, but the air that you need to breathe goes through the bottom of your nose, the very lowest part of your nostrils. And that's the area that the inferior nasal turbinate sits. Now, normally it looks like, as I said, looks like gills, very thin sheets of bone, which are curled into the nose. And you can see each of them individually if you look up your nose. Often, however, particularly in today's modern world with pollutants and all sorts of other things in the air, you get a swelling of these turbinates, swelling so large that they start blocking your nose. Typically, in a normal person, when you look in someone's nose, you can see right the back of their nose. And if you use a little camera, just at the entrance of your nose, you can see the palate moving at the back of your throat. So when you speak, the dangly thing at the back of your throat that goes sort of up and down. If you scream on cartoons, you see the uvula, the dangly thing at the back of your throat, sort of vibrating away. Or if you see people snoring, that's the area that a lot of people depict as flapping around. You see the other side of that palate at the back of your nose. So if you were to start speaking, you'd see this thing going up and down all the time. So this nose, you should be able to see all the way right back to the back of your nose, unless you have a twisted nose on one side. So then that side would be blocked because the deviated nasal septum, or the inferior nasal turbinate, is blocking your view and also the airflow to the back of your nose. It's very hard sometimes to work out whether or not you have a deviated nasal septum or large turbinates. And often there's a combination of the two. So a way to test whether or not your turbinates are a problem is to use a decongestant nasal spray. Decongestant sprays include things like Sudafed or Otrivine. And if you spray that up into your nose within about 10 to 15 minutes, if you have nasal obstruction due to turbinates, you'll find that the Otrivine or Sudafed will shrink down these turbinates to allow you to breathe better through your nose relatively quickly. Now, often it causes, if this is the first time you've ever tried decongestant sprays, it'll cause a little bit of stinging and other things in your nose, and it won't be very nice. But what you're really thinking for is subjectively, can you breathe better with the Sudafed? Do you breathe better with the Otrivine spray up your nose? And if you do, at least a component of your blocked nose is due to a swelling of your turbinates. I should also say that there are problems about using decongestant nasal sprays, and I'll come on to some of them later. But the most important thing is to remember that some people should not be using it. For example, you shouldn't be using it for pregnant people, because what decongestant nasal sprays do is they stop the blood flow going to your nose. That works very well in the short term. But if you're pregnant, some of that closing down the blood vessel effect may interfere with the blood flow through the placenta to your baby. And there are other problems. Different people have different problems with decongestant nasal sprays. So have a look at the online information about that. I'd have a look at that and use the decongestant nasal spray once. Maybe if you're just interested about how it's worthwhile just using it at night. It works for about 8 hours if this is the first ever time you've tried it. Use it just before you go to bed and see if your nose feels blocked in the morning. And the same thing during the day. If you feel if it's blocked during the day, you can try it at that time. If you're going to do a test, I'd only do it for one day because I don't want you to use it for too long. It's meant to be only a short-term drug, so don't use it for very long. We're on to the third reason why you may have a blocked nose. And this is called the lateral nasal wall collapse. Now, this is quite easy to see. You don't need drugs or anything like that to look at it. If you just look up the nose again, you don't have to use a camera or anything. Just look in the mirror at the inside of your nose. What I'd like you to do now is sniff. You may have to press one nostril flat and then sniff, breathe through the other side. But normally, if you just sniff, you might and try and get a good intake of air through your nose. You might notice that one side of your nose will collapse in. So the structure of your nose isn't quite as strong or stable on one side. So it collapses in and blocks your nose on that side. Sometimes it's on both sides. In my YouTube channel, I show it mine all the time. It doesn't affect me too much because I need to sniff quite hard for that to happen. If you have problems of that collapsing in, even at what we'd call tidal volume. So that means even when you're breathing normally through your nose, if your nose is starting to collapse, even with gentle breathing, you may notice that this is causing you an issue. So that's another reason why people have a blocked nose, purely because the sidewall of your nose isn't quite as strong. And so the wall collapses in when you take a breath in. So that's nice and quick. And I'll go on to the fourth reason, which are other masses inside your nose. So the most common of these are polyps or adenoids. Now, polyps are just very, very swollen parts of your nasal lining that's got so swollen that it's expanded to the point where it's blocking your whole nose. Now, we don't know why this happens. In the past, we used to think, oh, it's because you've got allergic rhinitis or asthma or some sort of allergy problem. But some people get polyps without any of those problems. Polyps are something that a lot of people have and completely block their nose. So if you did have a look up your nose and were able to see inside it, perhaps even with one of those small cameras, you'll see your normal turbinates, which should look relatively normal. They look like a red sort of fleshy colored. If you had polyps, you'll see a much whiter, clearer structure. Often people describe them looking like peeled grapes or peeled green grapes, and that they will sit possibly in between the turbinates, and they'll be expanding down and blocking the entire nose in some cases. If they're very small, these polyps, they can just block up your sinuses. And with sinus problems, you have pain in the bones of your face, in your cheekbones, between your eyes and in your forehead. And occasionally you get pain in your teeth and you feel like the upper teeth are loosening or there's a toothache in that area on one side or the other. And later when the pus drains from your sinuses, you get this horrible green, yellow, brown sometimes, or even blood coming out of your nose for a few weeks, until the antibiotics, whatever you've been given, helps. But we're talking about a blocked nose. We're not talking about sinusitis in this podcast. And so if you have polyps, that may be blocking your sinuses or even blocking your nose if they're big enough and causing you problems. In this situation, using decongestant nasal sprays like Sudafed or Otrivine will make no difference at all. You'll still not be able to breathe at all when using this. As I said before, Sudafed and Otrivine, decongestant nasal sprays wouldn't really help a lateral nasal wall collapse, and they don't help polyps, and they don't help a deviated nasal septum either, because you can't shrink down a movement of this sort of bone at the front of your nose or cartilage at the front of your nose. So the only thing it really helps is with turbinates, and they don't help with polyps at all. So the only thing that really helps with polyps is to use steroids. You can do an operation to remove them, but they generally come back again. And I'll talk about that later. The other mass that's very common in the nose that could be blocking your nose are the adenoids. The adenoids are right at the back of your nose. That's the junction between your nose and your throat. It's just if you were to try and snore, if you try to simulate snoring at the back of your throat, it's in that area just above, it's in between your ears almost. It's very hard to explain. And basically, adenoids are like tonsils, like the tonsils in your mouth, but in the back of your nose, along the back wall of your throat, just in the nose area, what we would call the post-nasal space. And they can become so large that they cause obstruction of your nose. Now, it is very hard to see adenoids without a telescope, what we'd call a flexible nasendoscope, to look through your nose, right to the back of your nose. So typically, you do need an ENT surgeon to have a look at this. And you can't do it with one of those sort of commercial cameras that look up your nose by yourself from Amazon or something. But if you did want to have a look at it, you'll need to go and see a ENT surgeon. But hopefully by thinking about the other sort of three, four reasons why you have a blocked nose, you might need to get to that point only if everything else you've checked out has not resulted in working out why you have a blocked nose. Typically, people with large adenoids also have a eustachian tube dysfunction. And what I mean by that is that it's the junction between your ears and your nose. So some people who fly get very bad pain in their ears and they have to keep popping their ears to get rid of the fullness effect in their ears and the reduced hearing that people get. So if you have very large adenoids, typically the adenoids become so large that they block that junction, the eustachian tube between your ears and your nose. And so if you're trying to work out whether or not you have large adenoids, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is if you have very large tonsils, you're very likely to have very large adenoids as well. It's not always the case, but can be an issue. The last thing I want to say about these three or four reasons why you have a blocked nose is that often there is a combination. So it's very often that you have a deviated nasal septum with large turbinates. And then you could also have, if you're unlucky enough, to have a lateral nasal wall collapse. It tends to happen to people with quite long protruding noses, sort of Caucasian type nose, which are quite thin in the middle. Or you could also have polyps on top of that. Or you could have polyps and large turbinates. You can have any combination of them. You could have all of them together or just two of them. So it is quite difficult in some cases to figure out exactly why you have a blocked nose. And often that in that situation, if it's not easy to understand, I'd go to a typical ENT surgeon and all of them would be able to help you with this problem. Now, what I'd like to do now is explain how you would treat each of these things in slightly more detail. The first is I went through a deviated nasal septum, that twist in your nose where one side of your nose twists to one side or the other. Typically, this septum being twisted to one side can be corrected by something known as a septoplasty. So septum, as I mentioned, and plasty means repair in Latin or something. And so correcting that part of your nose is all you're doing is you're rearranging the cartilage and the bones and straightening them all up so you can breathe equally on both sides. This is not often as difficult as it sounds. It takes about 20 minutes, sometimes half an hour. In very difficult cases, it takes about 45 minutes, and it's relatively easy to do. Typically, there is a little cut on the inside of your nose on one side or the other. And what you need to do is get to those bones or bits of cartilage which are sticking out, either remove them from the inside of your nose or actually take them out, flatten them up, and then put them back into your nose in the same place to sort of maintain the structure of your nose and the integrity and the strength of your nose so you can have a punch to the nose and it not collapse. There are areas of your nose that we know that we should not touch, the bit right at the front. And the what we call the L strut. So that goes from the bone at the top of your nose, and then run your finger down from the bone at the top of your nose down towards the tip of your nose. So that's one part of the L, the standing up part of the L. And then you curl around the tip of your nose down towards your front teeth in the midline, and that would be the other part of the L. So the small amount of cartilage in that area, typically we do not touch in a septoplasty because we want to maintain the integrity of the nose. But the rest of it, typically if it's further back, you can see that, there's a twist on one side or there's a bit of bone that's jutting out on one side. I just need to put that back into place or remove it all together. And then what we tend to do is stitch it into that area, stitch up the small wound we've made, which is typically a centimeter or a centimeter and a half in size. And then you pull out all your instruments, you get rid of the headlight. And then when you wake up later, you should have no bruising around your face, should have no sort of swelling of your nose. It'll look entirely normal as it did before, except obviously you'll look quite blocked up. Sometimes it's not as easy as that. Sometimes just doing a simple septoplasty lasting about 25 minutes or so is not enough to correct people's noses. For example, I said at the time when we were looking at the four reasons that a deviated nasal septum, you can notice it if the outside of your nose is twisted to one side. Rather than having to look inside to see if it's twisted, the outside of your nose looks pushed over to one side or the other. So the bridge of your nose is pointing one way or the other rather than staying in the midline. In that situation, you can't just often get away with just internally changing the shape of your nose. You may need to change the shape of all of your nose, even the outwardly appearance. And that would be called a septorhinoplasty. So septum, you know about, and plasty at the end is repair of. And the rhino bit is the outwardly appearance, the bridge of your nose, the bones of your nose. In that situation, often what happens is that your nose is broken, the bones are broken on the outside of your nose and straightened up. So the septum can sit in a straight position. Often in these cases, you can get some bruising around your eyes, around the nose. You can get, you may wake up with this plaster of Paris or a metal splint on top of your nose. So you have these stickers or other things on top of your nose, which sort of, they protect it slightly, but more they remind you that not to sleep on your nose and push it back in the other way. You look like you've had a much bigger operation, and these operations can take much longer, sort of sometimes a few hours at times. I've heard of these operations lasting 4 hours in some cases. Although it sounds like a cosmetic operation, often people have it for cosmetic reasons. The main reason that I'm considering it in this podcast is to explain to you that we need to straighten up the nose so you can breathe equally from both of your nostrils on both sides. So if you understand the difference now, that there's the septoplasty, which is very much an internal operation with no outwardly appearance of the operation afterwards. And then there's the septorhinoplasty, which is in effect a nose job, which a lot of people may have heard of before. And that's sort of correcting the cosmetic look of it, but also straightening up the septum so it sits in the center. Now, an awful lot of people may have a septorhinoplasty without really caring about the cosmetic appearance of their nose. They just need to have it straightened up purely to help them with the function of their nose. And that's a very sensible thing to do. Often a septoplasty doesn't work very well if your external appearance of your nose looks like it's twisted to one side or the other. A septorhinoplasty is often very different in different people, so I'm not going to talk about that in too much detail. I'll talk more about a septoplasty, which is, you know, the most common way of fixing a deviated nasal septum. And that operation, as I said, is about 20 minutes to 40 minutes, and there's very minimal blood loss. Often you don't need nasal packing. These are these huge tampons that you put up people's noses to stem the bleeding afterwards. If you just wait 5 minutes or so at the end of the operation, you can wait until all the bleeding has stopped, stop any bleeding if there is anything in there, and then wake the patient up. I think in the last sort of 20 years, I think I've only put in one or two packs in people's noses during an operation. So it's very rare that you actually need to do it. The reason why I don't like doing it is because people, when they've woken up, they don't particularly like having their nasal packs pulled out of their nose afterwards. This huge red thing coming out their nose, it's a bit painful. And it also scratches along the areas of your nose, which you've just stitched or cut or whatever. So it can be quite painful. So as I said, I don't particularly like doing it. If I really had to do it, what I tend to do is leave it in for a few hours to stem the bleeding if someone was bleeding a lot during their operation. And then I would wet the tampon inside their nose. So you squirt normal saline or something like that into the nose to make it wet. So when it does come, it just sort of slips out rather than being attached to clots and things inside your nose. Another way to do it is to wet the this tampon with a local anesthetic. And that's quite useful because it's like a sponge in your nose. And this local anesthetic percolates through the sponge and numbs the inside of your nose. So when you do pull it out, it feels much nicer. But as I said, in the thousands or so of these septoplasties that I've done, I've only done one or two that needed a pack during the operation. I should also mention, because a lot of my patients have actually use CPAP, a mask on their face at night, I would like you to use CPAP after these operations and before if you can. You may find that you need to turn up the humidity of your CPAP device. The reason for that is that your nose can get very dry in the first few months. And the idea is that by putting more moisture up your nose, the crust and the hard bogies and clots and debris that seem to occur in the first few weeks after this operation, don't become so hard that it's very hard to blow it out in the morning. So I want you, well, this is for my patients, it may be different for other surgeons. For my patients, I want you to blow your nose, often as hard as you like. The chance of bleeding is infinitesimally small. I don't think I've had a serious nasal bleed or after people have gone home. And what I'd like you to do is keep blowing your nose, getting rid of all the stuff that fills up your nose. I don't want you to be blocked up. It's like, I don't know why people sort of think that they can't blow their nose. It's the risk of bleeding is very low in septoplasty patients, at least in my cohort anyway. Most surgeons I know allow their patients to blow their nose, clear out all this debris so they can breathe through their nose. Getting air to your nose is very useful. I give people loads of salt water afterwards, either with a Neil Med sinus rinse, which is like a big squeezy bottle of salt water, or I use hypertonic Sterimar, which is very salty seawater that's sprayed up their nose. And the more they spray and wash out their nose, the more they blow their nose, the more of this debris can come out so they can breathe better. Since we're on the topic, what I also do is give people steroid nasal sprays for at least 3 months afterwards. And the idea behind this is I want it to heal in a good position. I don't want it to heal in a sort of inflamed position. And using that seems to help my patients. The other thing I want, after those 3 months, you don't need to keep using the steroid nasal sprays. The last thing I often give is some antibiotic nasal cream as well. So when you're blowing your nose and this big sort of black, angry looking slug comes out of your nose, it's a bit like a bit of scab coming off your, like a grazed knee. You're trying to get rid of these things, but you don't want to sort of pick them off. You want to moisten them so they come off, a bit like a scab comes off in the shower. But when they do come off, you have a red raw area there. And so what is useful is to use the antibiotic cream, which has got a bit of emollient sort of moisturizing cream on it, which protects and causes a little barrier over there so it doesn't fill up with this scab again. But it also has a little bit of antibiotic on it, which helps prevent infections to a small degree. So it is useful to use, particularly if you're blowing out an all bunch of this stuff coming out your nose. You can put this cream up your nose. Don't shove your finger up your nose because it will just percolate up and by itself, but just put it in the entrance of your nose and rub very gently. It will make its own way up with the little hair cells in your nose, which transports bogey away. It'll transport your antibiotic away as well, and it will cover these red raw areas and hopefully prevent infections and other things that can cause problems after this operation. So now I'm going to talk about turbinates. We talked about the deviated nasal septum with septoplasty and septorhinoplasty and some of the things you need to do to look after yourself after these operations. I'd like to talk to you about turbinates. As I said before, you can use a decongestant nasal spray for 1 day just to see if your turbinates are a problem. And if they are a problem, well, then that's great. You might find that spraying Otrivine or Sudafed up your nose may unblock one side but not the other side. And that may be because you have a deviated nasal septum, say, to your right-hand side. So if you spray it up that side, yes, the turbinate may shrink down, but it doesn't help the deviated nasal septum or the polyps or adenoids, whatever, are blocking that side. Whereas on the other side, it works beautifully because the septum is deviated over to the right. And on the left-hand side, your big turbinate has shrunk down. Then all of a sudden, wow, I can breathe great through my left-hand side. So at least you know a component of the obstruction you have is due to your turbinates. So another way to do this, rather than using these decongestant nasal sprays, is just to really hold your breath for as absolutely long as you possibly can to see if this opens up your nose. So you pinch your nose, hold your mouth closed until your face goes bright red. Obviously, don't do this if this is any danger to yourself, but hold it for as long as you can till your face feels red and hot, and then let go and breathe through your nose. You'll suddenly find that your nose opens up. It's a bit of an adrenaline rush. There's slightly more carbon dioxide in your body, which creates a situation where your nose opens up. And so if your nose does open up in that situation, you know that it's more of a turbinate problem, or at least a component of your blocked nose is due to turbinates. Now, there are lots of reasons why your turbinates may swell up. And the most common reason is because of something known as rhinitis. So it's typically an allergic rhinitis, which means swelling of the turbinates. And this could be because of house dust mite, or hay fever, or something simple like a common cold or something like that. But I'm not going to talk about that. There is such a thing as non-allergic rhinitis, which is caused by smoke and irritated by pollutants and things like that. Say if you have a house dust mite allergy, I have a video on this, which goes into a lot more detail about house dust mite allergy. This is typically found in sort of warm, clean houses, particularly in the UK, with not great ventilation, where the windows aren't open as. But England is a great place. North America is a great place for house dust mite. So if you know you have a house dust mite allergy, you can do this by doing a blood test called a RAST test or a skin prick test, where they make little needle marks on your hand, on the back of your arm, and then you can see exactly which things you're allergic to. And house dust mite is one of them. You can reduce the amount of house dust mite in your home by getting rid of carpets, changing everything to hypoallergenic stuff. But as some of you will know, I have house dust mite allergy, and that didn't really help me at all. I changed everything from carpet to wood. Everything is hypoallergenic, and I still had lots of house dust mite in my house, purely because we have a lot of soft furnishings and things like that. And the way I found to get rid of house dust mite allergy is to try and get rid of the house dust mite. The thing that worked best for me and my son was to dehumidify the house as much as possible. So it often takes several months. I bought a pretty expensive dehumidifier and let it run for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, typically sort of 3 or 4 months when I move into a new house. Normally in English homes, the humidity in our house was about 60%, and I managed to get down to about 35, 40%. Once you're down to that level humidity inside your home, the house dust mite tends to die. That doesn't mean you don't have house dust mite, because you're still allergic to the, as it were, the body parts of house dust mite. And so you do need to get a Hoover or a vacuum cleaner and clean out as much as you possibly can. You need to have one which has got a HEPA filter on it to try and suck up all this house dust mite. And sometimes I use a air purifier with a HEPA filter. But once you've cleared out a lot of the house dust mite and you've kept the humidity down to about 35, 40%, I no longer need to use a nasal spray because of my house dust mite allergy. My son doesn't get so much asthma. So all of these things have been really useful for me in terms of reducing house dust mite allergy. If you did look at that video on house dust mite allergy, there is a free ebook that comes with it. So if you look at that, it'll give you more information about all the different other things that you can get, which will help you with eradicating house dust mite from your home. And I had variable results with all of them, but I did give all the evidence for all the different types of house dust mite eradication. You may have a hay fever problem with allergic rhinitis. And there is now lots of sprays and things that I'll talk about in a minute, but there's also a cure for a hay fever. You can get, I think there's also a cure for house dust mite as well, where it's called desensitization. You're giving a very tiny amount of house dust mite or a very tiny amount of grass or tree pollen, and you keep giving that to the body until the body goes, oh, this isn't as bad as we thought it was, until eventually you no longer have an allergy to grass or whatever. You can enjoy the sunshine in the summer months without getting these problems. In London, for example, everyone has problems, it seems, for London plane. It's a London plane tree that we have. Lots of people are allergic to it, and I'm not sure if there's an allergy test for it, or even if there's a cure for it with desensitization. But immunotherapy is quite useful for hay fever. Now, we'll talk about some of the other things you can do if you've just got big turbinates and you're not sure whether or not you have house dust mite allergy or hay fever. But I did want to say that antihistamines, you know, like Pyriton and Claritin and all those sorts of drugs, they don't really work for a blocked nose. And that's the topic of this podcast. They do work for other things like itchy eyes and itchy throat and things like that, but they don't really work for a blocked nose. So I wouldn't use it for that reason. There are things called leukotriene antagonists or Montelukast. You may be given these, particularly if you have asthma. They seem to find there's a bit of a combination. If you use something for your asthma and you've also got a blocked nose, those two very commonly come together because of big turbinates. In that situation, Montelukast, if you have asthma, can help. But typically, you need an awful lot of treatment for your asthma to get onto that level. But it's something you can talk to your asthma physician about if that is something that you have a combination problem with. However, if you want to be as natural as you possibly can, a way to shrink down your turbinates is to use something called saline, or otherwise known as just salt water. Now, if you just used what we call isotonic salt water, just as salty as your own body, when you spray this stuff up your nose or you sniff it up, it'll just clean out the allergens from inside your nose or the pollutants from inside your nose, stopping it from being irritated. But I would recommend going even more saltier than just isotonic, so what we would call hypertonic. And if you use something very salty up your nose, it shrinks down your turbinates for a short time. Now, it doesn't last very long, and you do need to spray several times during the day, but at least it's natural. Because some of these drugs people don't want to take. People don't want to take steroid sprays, for example, and I'll come on to that in a minute. If you want to avoid any sort of medication and you don't mind using very salty water up your nose, this is one way to shrink down your turbinate so you can breathe better, and that may help you get through a night of blocked nose. Or if you're going for exercise, you can spray your nose before you go and spray it afterwards so you can get rid of all the allergens in your nose when you come back from your workout. These are things you can do which are natural, but in the vast majority of cases, you do need a steroid spray. Now, the problem with steroid sprays, particularly in the past, is that they go into your nose and they spread through your entire body, giving you all the side effects of steroid sprays. So for kids, we worried about growth retardation. Women worry that their steroids will make their bones weak. I guess that could happen to men as well. But you can get fatter with steroids if you take much of them, too much of them. And they can also cause other problems, which you don't really want to happen. So the newer class of steroid sprays stay within your nose. For example, a drug named Nasonex, I think there's only a 0.01% chance of it getting into your body. It stays in your nose and only works in that area there. It doesn't spread through your whole body. There's other good sprays like Flixonase, Dimista. Dimista is an interesting one because it's got antihistamine with it, which seems to help it a little bit better with some of the other symptoms. Not a blocked nose, but as I said, the steroid component of it is also good at staying in your nose, not spreading through your whole body. I would avoid things like Beconase, Betnazole, Vistamethasone. All of those drugs go through your whole body, and it's effectively taking a tablet of steroids, which would work really well for your blocked nose if you've got a big turbinate, but it's not what you want with all the side effects as well. Those sorts of drugs are only licensed for 3 months and shouldn't be used longer than that. So if you want to use a drug for the rest of your life for your big turbinates, you'd need to use one of these newer class of steroid nasal sprays. And there have been studies on people using it for 35 years with no real after effect. There is some evidence that using steroid sprays for too long, particularly if you're elderly, can cause weakness of the lining of your nose, causing bleeding. But when you look at it, I think a lot of older people do have thin skin in their nose and they seem to bleed anyway. So we don't really have an awful lot of evidence, as far as I know, that using steroid sprays causes nosebleeds. It can happen to some people, but it's normally because of a reaction to the preservatives inside these sprays. And if you have that, I'd go to a different variety, such as Flixonase, Nasonex, Dimista, all these other different types of sprays, to work out which one you don't have a reaction to the preservatives. And if this is not working for you, and typically these nasal sprays need to be taken really well for at least sort of 3 or 4 months before you start noticing the really good benefits from it, and you have to use it twice a day, every day. You can't just use a little dose and think you can get away with it. You can't just use it for a bit and then stop. You've got to keep using it constantly. But if you're in that situation, you've used it for 3 or 4 months religiously, morning and night without stopping, and you're still not getting better, even though you've got really good technique of using these nasal sprays. Sorry, I should mention the technique is to spray it up your nose and do not sniff it up. You want it to be in your nose for as long as possible. You need to aim it towards your turbinate, so the side of your nose, rather than going down the middle. You don't want to be able to taste this drug. You want it to stay in your nose for as long as possible, so it sits there and works as well as possible. It's also useful to clean out the nose with a salt water preparation. That way you clean off some of the allergens and some of the mucus in your nose, so when the spray goes in, it touches the nasal lining of your nose rather than other parts of your nose, which it's not going to work on. So if you're in that situation, even though you've got a good technique, you've used it for a long time, and you still can't get rid of your large nasal turbinates, you may need surgery to shrink down these turbinates. I am very scared of a condition called empty nose syndrome, which is when you remove the turbinates and then there's a 9 to 13% chance of you getting this thing where you feel like there's too much air going into your nose. You feel weirdly congested from it. So I don't remove any of the turbinates at all. All I do is shrink down the lining of the nose just at the bottom corner of the turbinate. I still leave the rest of the inferior turbinate so it can swell up later, but I just leave a channel so you can breathe through. So I guess I'm very gentle with the turbinates. I don't want to remove any bone because I'm so fearful of empty nose syndrome. And there's a video about it. And there's a couple of videos about it on my YouTube channel. If you want to try and avoid that operation, use your nasal sprays. If you are going to have a surgery and you're worried about causing a problem leading to empty nose syndrome, I would not let any of the bone be removed. And I'd only shrink down the lining of your nose. Make sure that this ablation technique or a coblation technique does not touch the bone at all, because if you damage the bone, it can drop off by itself. The surgeon may not have removed it, but if you incorrectly use these ablation techniques, you can damage the bone of the nose and that drops off in itself anyway. I wouldn't go too high. That's the other reason I don't like doing this operation on people, because if you out-fracture the nose, you push it out the way, you can cause a fracture line. And if you cauterize that area near the fracture line, the whole turbinate can fall out anyway. So being very careful about how you shrink down turbinates is important. There are videos on my YouTube channel and I explain this in more detail there. It's quite hard to explain on a podcast. You really notice the difference between YouTube and podcast in these situations. I am learning how to do this one by one. Anyway, the other thing to think about is that if you have a deviated nasal septum, say on your right-hand side, so your nose is more blocked on that right-hand side, but you have a blocked nose on your left-hand side, it would be worth sleeping on your right-hand side at night and only sleeping on your right-hand side. That way, the left nostril is pointing up towards the ceiling almost, because when you do that, you create what's known as an Epley's reflex, or as I think the Americans call it, crutch reflex. Because if you sleep on one side, if you slept on your right-hand side, the turbinate on the left-hand side shrinks down to allow you to breathe through that side. So if you'd slept on your left-hand side, that's the side where your turbinate is big at the moment, all you're going to do is make that side bigger and the turbinate on the right-hand side will shrink down, which sounds okay, but if you have a deviated nasal septum to the right, you can't breathe through that side anyway, and therefore you'll be completely blocked up. So if you have a deviated nasal septum with large turbinates, sleep on the side of your obstruction for the septum to allow that good side, which has only got an obstruction due to turbinates, to breathe more freely, because if you sleep on one side, the other side will open up. And some of you will know that I'm in the process currently of manufacturing a pillow that helps you sleep on your side so you don't get the shoulder pain. Nose is not obstructed by sleeping in the pillow. You can sleep onto one side and let your tongue roll forward. All these little things. I'm currently in the process of making this. It's quite exciting now. I get to the point where I'm looking for a shipment to bring it to England and America. I'm looking for a fulfillment center. I'll talk about that in another video, I guess. So now I'm going to talk about the treatment options for the lateral nasal wall collapse. That's a bit when you sniff in and you can see the side wall of your nose collapse in. As I said before, it seems to happen in people with long, pointy, thin noses, Caucasian type noses. I've got one of these. So my right nostril tends to collapse in. It doesn't tend to happen in other ethnicities so much, but in my sort of Caucasian looking nose, because I'm North Indian, that side of my nose does collapse in quite a lot. It doesn't, as I said before, doesn't affect me as much as other people. But if you have a major problem in this area here, you can use certain things that can help you breathe better. It's mostly at the start, sort of improving the structure and the integrity of your nose on that side. So some people use Breathe Right strips, which is basically a stiff plaster that sticks onto your nose on both sides and then props open the nose by lifting it up. Now, some people use this in their sport. So I'm a Liverpool fan, so Robbie Fowler used to use this quite a lot to help him breathe through his nose. And then there's sort of Alex Hormozi that uses it quite a lot. I think he might have had his nose operated now, because I haven't seen it on his nose frequently since then. But there are all sorts of things that can open up your nose, and it pulls your nostrils apart, so it helps you breathe without it collapsing in. If you don't want to use the Breathe Right strips or other sort of alternatives you can get, because they cause sort of a reaction to the glue and you get a red nose. You can get this sort of line on your nose in the morning if you're using it at night. You can use nasal dilators. Now, these are bits of plastic typically that go up your nose and sort of splint the airway open. And you have these called, they're called like Mute or Air Max. And there are other trade names or brands out there that can hold your nose open. I think when I did a little review in one of my videos, I thought that Mute was quite good because you can increase or decrease the size of these things. And they're relatively comfortable. The only problem is that they press onto the septum and some people can get nosebleeds from them if you use them for too long, and they can cause some irritation from inside your nose. But on the most part, people don't need to go any further than using a nasal dilator. There are operations out there that can fix this thing. There's a thing in my YouTube channel called the Latera device, which is basically a strut that under local anesthetic you inject into the sidewall of your nose just to increase the strength and integrity of that sidewall to stop it from falling in. It's not perfect, but it's a local anesthetic thing that you can squirt in sort of in a clinic environment, and then you can go home straight afterwards. I've tried it out on a few patients and it seems to work, but it doesn't work instantly. I thought, oh no, it doesn't do anything. I tried it in the first week or so. It didn't seem to make any difference. But when you see these patients back after about 2 or 3 months, I thought, wow, it really is working. And people are much more pleased later on. I think it's because it causes a slight reaction in that area, causes scar tissue to form around this device that's inserted, this sort of strut that's put inside your nose. And what that does is that it stabilizes the nose, stops it from falling in quite as much. So actually, although I wasn't very sure if it was going to work very well, it does make a difference. But you need to give it a bit of time for it to work. And I'm very happy with those results in those people who only have a lateral nasal wall collapse. And it can be done under local anesthetic in your clinic room if you really want to. But most people, I've so far, but maybe it's an England or London thing, most people want it done whilst they're sleeping, which is fine. The only other thing that you can use is something known as a septal rhinoplasty, which is something which, as I mentioned before, in the deviated nasal septum and the dorsum of your nose twisted, there are lots of techniques that the septal rhinoplasty surgeon will employ to strengthen up that nose. And it could be putting a little bit of cartilage from somewhere else into that area to strengthen up that side. Now, all of these things typically have a cosmetic alteration of your nose. So you just need to be a little bit careful and figure out how far you want to go with this before you do this. But if you find a really good surgeon who says, look, I'm not going to change the shape of your nose, I'm going to do this and I'm going to make sure it looks the same as it does now, just be stronger. Well, that's the sort of person you should go and see. I don't do cosmetic operations at all, so it's not my thing at all. I just seem to stop at Latera if that's as far as I'm going to go, or you know, I just give them nasal dilators and things. But you should see one of these septal rhinoplasty type surgeons who does cosmetic work, because it's not my thing. Cosmetic surgery, although I'm not saying it's not a good thing, it's just not for me, basically. So the last thing I want to talk about is the polyps and adenoids. There are actually lots of different masses that can block the nose, and I don't want to go through all of them, but the most common two are polyps and adenoids. The polyps are in your nose near your sinuses. The adenoids are right at the back of your nose near the Eustachian tube, near the bit where you start snoring. Now, for polyps, the main treatment is steroids. So the treatment option we talk about is something known as a chemical polypectomy. That means giving oral steroids, a tablet of steroids for about sort of 9 to 10 days or so, to shrink down all the polyps in your nose. That works beautifully for getting rid of all the polyps inside your nose. The trouble is, as soon as you stop the steroids, all the polyps grow back again. And you can't keep having repeated doses of steroids because it causes all the other side effects of steroids. What you want to do is get rid of the polyps so you can breathe up your nose, and then use a steroid nasal spray to maintain it like that. So steroid nasal sprays are okay for polyps, but they don't really shrink down huge polyps that are completely blocking your nose or you can't get into the sinuses. You almost have to take the tablets to shrink it all down, bring your nose back to a normal setting, and then use the steroid sprays to maintain it like that. And you can do that for the rest of your life at that point. You can't take steroid tablets really for the rest of your life because it has lots of side effects. We're trying to avoid these side effects, but you can use a steroid nasal spray as long as it's one of these newer ones I talked about for the turbinate section. You can use that for the rest of your life. So you take the steroid tablets, shrink all the polyps down, then you take the steroid spray to maintain that effect for forever. Now, some people will know, and I've even got a video on my YouTube channel about this, where you can remove the polyps, and that works very well. But it's a bit like taking doses of oral steroids. Within a few months, they grow back again. You have to start all over again. So it's not very useful for that. If someone is terribly scared or is unable to take oral steroids, well, that might be an option for them. But on the most part, taking out polyps does not help. stop them from coming back. You do need to take the steroids at the same time. There is something known as a Fez polypectomy. Fez stands for functional endoscopic sinus surgery. So what you're doing is removing the polyps and the root area where the polyps grow from. This is the junction between your sinuses and your nose. That area there is also cleaned out a little bit, so it's made more open. The idea behind this is that when you take out the polyps, sometimes people are spraying, being very religious about their steroid sprays afterwards because they've tried their tablets, they're onto the nasal spray, but the polyps still grow back. And that might be because of the anatomy in your nose does not allow for the spray to get into that corner where the polyps start growing from. And so what you tend to do with a Fez polypectomy is to remove the polyps and then open up that space. You clear out the polyps for a short time. You give patients some steroid sprays and you say to them, at the moment, there are no polyps in there, but now I've opened up the space. So when you spray, the spray actually gets to where the polyps originate from. And when the spray goes in, it stops it from growing at that root area. It doesn't really work by removing the polyps and doing a Fez polypectomy, removing the root cause of the area where these polyps come from and hoping that the polyps don't grow back. It doesn't really work that way. Some people are very lucky and tends not to cause them a problem long term. But in the vast majority of cases, you need to take out the polyps either with a steroid tablet or the Fez polypectomy and then use the steroid nasal spray afterwards to keep that area maintained, stop it from growing back again. Now, there's an awful lot of more information about polyps, which I don't want to really go into because it's a whole new podcast, I think, when it comes to polyps. There's a huge, I think, like 400-page international document on it. If you look at the EPOS guidelines, for example, you'll see actually there's an awful lot of information there. And I don't want to go through all of it because there are different types of polyps for different types of people. And there's Samter's triad, a few sensitivity to aspirin and things like that. So I'm going to leave that for another day. But the other thing I did want to talk about was adenoids. Adenoids are these big tonsils, as it were, at the back of your nose. And using steroid nasal sprays, again, can shrink it down by sort of 5% or so. It's not that useful in these situations. We sometimes give steroid sprays or drops to children, hoping that they shrink down their adenoids to the point where they grow a little bit older. Adenoids tend to shrink with age and by adulthood. Most people don't have adenoids at all. They all shrink down a bit like tonsils. But what you're trying to do is shrink it down so that the child can breathe till the point where they go through puberty and the adenoids start shrinking down to it's no longer a problem anymore. So it can be used as a bridging therapy to avoid an operation. But typically, if you have such large adenoids and they're causing problems and you need to have an operation, in the old days, we used to scrape them out. You can't do it like a tonsil because they have it has a capsule. The adenoids are sort of attached to your, you know, the bones of your spine, not actually to the bone, but the overlying structures next to your spine. So you can't remove it in its entirety. You just scrape down the surface of it to get rid of the volume. The other technique, and rather than using like a scraping technique, is the Great Ormond Street technique, which is a hospital nearby here, a children's hospital. And you sort of vaporize the adenoid bit by bit and suction out that vaporized tissue. Now, a lot of people sort of use this technique as a cauterization tool, which you shouldn't do. It shouldn't look black and sort of charred afterwards. It should be almost white as you remove it. So you slowly vaporize, not even touch the tissue. You vaporize the tissue until it's down to that layer near the back wall of your throat. And you do it on both sides so you can breathe well afterwards. This has a lower recurrence rate. That means that it doesn't grow back again quite as often. And it seems to cause less complications in general. So most people have moved over to this monopolar suction diathermy technique. I think some people are using poblation techniques. I haven't seen much good data on this compared to the monopolar suction diathermy. But so many people seem to do the adenoidal technique poorly. They just find someone who has sort of looked at the Great Ormond Street technique and knows properly how to do it without needing to simply cauterize it and make it go black and charred, because that's the last thing you really want. Now, I do appreciate that I've said an awful lot of things in this podcast, and I sometimes worry I overload people with loads of information, but there is so much out there. But I thought this was a useful overview for people out there who just want to get going in terms of how to deal with a blocked nose. There is a playlist, I believe, on my YouTube channel, which is all about nasal problems. And hopefully you can find other information there that could be useful to you. I also have some free questionnaires on my personal website at consultantsurgeon.co.uk. I'll leave a link for it somewhere. And with that, you can fill out some questionnaires to do with the nose. There's actually a questionnaire called the nose questionnaire. And if you follow that, that gives you an idea of how blocked your nose is. So you can show that to your doctor and say, it may not look very blocked to you, but it feels blocked to me. And that can help people understand exactly what's going on. And from time to time, I also provide information that may be useful to you in my newsletter. So I send out an email roughly once a month that could be quite useful to you. So sign up for my newsletter. Again, it'll be in the video description or the description you saw when you signed up for this podcast. I do hope you found this useful. Do take care. Bye-bye.